Hello. Welcome to everyone who's watching and listening online and everyone gathered in this place. It continues to be an encouraging experience for me to see not only all of you here, but also to know that so many are still participating online and that we are one church meeting in a variety of locations right now. It is a testimony to our unity as a church, but also the power and blessing of technology and the perseverance we have to stick together, even through some very difficult times. I have always enjoyed hearing movie casting what-if stories. I'm talking about those stories of how a well-known actor is almost cast in a role made famous or iconic by another actor, to the point that in hindsight, we can't imagine that first actor, or any other actor for that matter, playing that role because the second actor was so perfect for the part. My favorite example of this is when Tom Selleck and his mustache almost played Indiana Jones. I'm a big Tom Selleck fan. Magnum P.I., Frank Reagan, I like him, but I can't imagine anybody and don't want to imagine anybody else playing Indiana Jones other than Harrison Ford. He was made for that role. And speaking of Harrison Ford, did you know that Al Pacino was initially targeted to play the role of Han Solo? Thankfully, that was an offer he could refuse. And another example is from Lonesome Dove, which is the greatest Western, the greatest miniseries of all time. And originally, Robert Duvall was cast to play the role of Captain Woodrow Call. Tommy Lee Jones was going to play Augustus McCrae, but then God intervened and they swapped roles. Jones played Captain Call and Robert Duvall played Gus McCrae, as it should be. In today's message, we're going to focus on a short scene in the Gospel of John that encourages us to not only accept the role we're given in God's story, but also to play it as no one else can. It comes at the beginning, or at the end, rather, of chapter 21, which is also the end of the gospel. And you remember from last week that Jesus and Peter are walking along the beach, and Jesus gives Peter a job to do. He says, "Feed my sheep, take care of my lambs." And then in verse 18 and 19, he tells Peter that someday he is going to glorify God by dying as a martyr. And then in a clever play on words, after Jesus calls Peter to figuratively follow him all the way to the cross, we read in verse 20 that Peter turns around and sees the disciple whom Jesus loved, also known as the beloved disciple, was literally following them. And John then reminds us that this mysterious, beloved disciple first appeared in the gospel back in chapter 13 when Jesus predicted Judas's betrayal. And then he continues to show up in almost every important scene in the remainder of the gospel of John. And he appears always, with one notable exception, alongside Peter. Or maybe Peter appears alongside the beloved disciple. One of the ways of characterizing their relationship is as friendly rivals. Let me show you what I mean. Chapter 13, after Jesus predicts that one of his disciples will indeed betray him, we read in verse 23, "One of them, the disciple whom Jesus loved, was reclining next to Jesus. And Simon Peter motioned to this disciple and said, 'Ask him which one he means.' And leaning back against Jesus, the beloved disciple asked him, 'Lord, who is it?'" It's the beloved disciple, not Peter, who occupies the most prominent place at the table next to Jesus. So that all Peter can do is motion to the beloved disciple to ask Jesus who he's talking about, because Peter's not close enough to Jesus to ask him directly. And in those kind of settings, proximity matters. It's not long after that that Peter tries to differentiate himself from the other disciples by vowing to Jesus, "I will lay down my life for you." And then in chapter 18, just after Jesus is arrested, we read beginning in verse 15, "Simon Peter and another disciple were following Jesus. Because this disciple was known to the high priest, he went with Jesus into the high priest's courtyard. But Peter had to wait outside at the door. The other disciple, who was known to the high priest, came back, spoke to the servant girl on duty there, and brought Peter in." Most scholars believe and assume that this other disciple who uses his connections to get Peter into the courtyard of the high priest is the beloved disciple. And if that's true, then it's also likely that the beloved disciple was there warming himself by the fire when Peter denied Jesus three times. And they appear together again in chapter 20. This time they're both racing to the empty tomb after Mary Magdalene reports that Jesus' body is missing or has been moved. And the beloved disciple gets to the empty tomb first. He's faster than Peter, maybe because he's younger than Peter. He gets there first, but he doesn't go in. He waits and defers to Peter, who, when he arrives, goes straight into the empty tomb, sees Jesus' burial clothes discarded there, and does not make the connection. But then the beloved disciple enters the empty tomb and sees and believes, even though he does not yet fully understand. And then, of course, they're both together in chapter 21, fishing. And it's the beloved disciple, not Peter, who recognizes the risen Lord standing on the shore, prompting Peter to jump into the water and start swimming, maybe because he knows how fast the beloved disciple is on land, and he's determined to get to Jesus first. The only time they don't appear together in the Gospel of John is in chapter 19 at the cross, when the beloved disciple is there with a few other women, including Jesus' mother. The beloved disciple, not Peter, is the only male disciple present at Jesus' crucifixion. And Jesus asks the beloved disciple, not Peter, to look after his mother. In all of these scenes, the beloved disciple is portrayed more positively than Peter. He's faster, he's more faithful, he has more insight. Oh, yeah, in chapter 21, verse 24, he's also revealed to be the author of the Gospel of John, which may explain why he is portrayed in such a positive light. We'll talk more about the identity of the beloved disciple next week. But for now, assuming that there is this competitive tension between Peter and the beloved disciple, then after Jesus gives Peter his mission, which includes dying as a martyr, and Peter looks behind him and sees the beloved disciple following them, it is understandable that Peter would then ask Jesus in verse 21, "Lord, what about him? What about him?" This is one of the great, if lesser known, Peter being Peter moments in all the Gospels. His walk and talk with Jesus on the beach may have begun to heal his heart. It may have given him a new mission and purpose in life, but it did not change his personality. He simply cannot leave a tender moment alone. And he responds to Jesus' solemn prediction about the way he will die by looking back and asking Jesus about the fate of his friendly rival who always seems to be a step ahead of him, even when he's walking behind him. "What about him?" Peter asked. "How's he going to die? What about him? How long will he live? What about him? Which one of us will go down in history as the greatest of your disciples?" You have a rival? A rival, not an enemy, not an adversary. A rival. Maybe a lifelong friend, maybe a sibling, maybe a coworker, maybe someone you graduated with and you've been keeping track of his or her career ever since. Do you have a rival? Someone who always seems to be one step ahead of you, or maybe someone you have to work very hard to stay one step ahead of, a rival. If you have a rival, someone with whom you're always competing, or someone to whom you're always comparing yourself, then you understand Peter's question. Because you too are always asking, hey, what about him? What about her? If you can only measure your performance relative to your rival's performance, am I doing better than he is? How's she doing? Am I ahead or am I behind? Then you understand Peter's question. If when you receive your letter of acceptance, you ask, or you say, oh, good, I got in. And then you ask, what about him? What schools did he get into? Or what about her? How big is her scholarship? Then you definitely, totally understand Peter's question. And you also need to hear Jesus' response in verse 22, which I think contains one of the secrets to living a joy-filled, purposeful life. This is what Jesus says. If I want him to remain alive until I return, what is that to you? The risen Jesus has a little bit of a sense of humor. What is that to you? You follow me. That's pure gold from Jesus. Peter asks, what about him? And Jesus says, it is none of your business what happens to him. The role he's going to play in this story is not your concern. You focus on the role I'm giving you to play. You're not competing with him. You're following me. So you stay in your lane. You stick to your path. Quit looking over at him. And you follow me. This exchange reminds me of a story that Jesus tells in Matthew 25 about a landowner who's going away on a journey. And before he leaves, you likely remember the story, before he leaves, he gives different amounts of money to three of his servants for them to manage, each according to their own ability. So to the first servant, he gives 5 bags of gold. To the second servant, he gives 2 bags of gold. To the first servant or third servant, he gives 1 bag of gold. And then when he comes back to judge their performance, he does not judge their performance relative to each other's performance. How did you do compared to him or her? He judges each one's performance according to what each one was given. What is that to you, what they're doing? You follow me. I've learned over the years that it is unhealthy for me to listen to a lot of other sermons that preachers preach. Although I have access to countless sermons online, I don't listen to that many sermons. And you're thinking at this point, boy, can we tell. It's just too easy for me to fall into the comparison trap. So when I listen to a rival preacher, and preachers do have rivals, when I listen to a rival preacher preach and I think, well, I'm better than that preacher, it lulls me into complacency. It encourages me to relax a bit, especially if my goal is just to stay one step ahead of the competition. Or I listen to a preacher and I think, that preacher is so much better than I am. It sends me into a tailspin of depression where I'm questioning the purpose of life and the meaning of my existence. Now, some of this is specific and unique to my personality, so your mileage may vary. But either way, when I'm looking over at a rival and gaining either a sense of superiority or inferiority, Jesus is the one who's ahead of me saying, "What is that to you? Stop looking over there and feeling content because you've pulled ahead. I have more for you to do. You follow me." Or stop looking over there and feeling sorry for yourself because you're behind. You are not called to be better than him or her. You're called to follow me. We are not judged relative to the performance of a rival to someone else. We are judged according to what we have been given to work with, what we have been given to do. And all of us are placed on a unique path to walk in life. All of us are given a unique role to play in advancing God's story. And the path you're walking, the path I'm walking, the role you're playing, the role I'm playing, is determined by a unique combination of our gifts and strengths and talents and skills, and stories and experiences, both the good and the bad, our successes, our failures, our victories, our defeats, our mistakes, our sins, the wisdom we've earned along the way. And one of the secrets to living a joy-filled, purposeful life is knowing what path the Lord has laid out for you. Knowing what role you've been given to play in God's story. Knowing what is yours and yours alone to do. One of the quickest and easiest ways to lose your sense of joy, to lose your sense of purpose, is to let yourself get distracted and diverted from your path by continually asking the question, what about him? What about her? What about them? What about that church? Teddy Roosevelt got it right when he said, "Comparison is the thief of joy." Comparison is the thief of joy, because there will always be someone who's bigger, stronger, faster, or skinnier, or smarter than you are. There will always be someone who has more money or more power or more opportunities or more resources than you do. There will always be someone who has better stories or less public failures than you. There will always be someone who appears to be a step ahead of you. What about him? He's married. I'm not. What is that to you? Jesus says, "You follow me." What about her? She's pregnant. I'm not. What is that to you? You follow me. What about him? He got the promotion. I didn't. What is that to you? You follow me. What about her? Her ministry is growing and mine's not. What is that to you? You follow me. What about him? His business is booming and mine's not. What is that to you? You follow me. None of this means we shouldn't set goals and pursue them. None of this means we shouldn't work harder or smarter. None of this means we shouldn't try to be the best that we can be. But it does mean our value is not measured by competing or being better than them. We're not competing with our rivals. We're following Jesus. And we become the best version of ourselves that we can be by following Jesus, not by chasing our rivals. So may God give you and me the clarity to know what is yours and mine to do. And may God give us the ability to focus on the path laid out for us, trusting that the role you've been given and the role I've been given cannot be played by anyone else in the world. It was made for us, and we were made for it. And let us not be distracted by the role someone else is playing. Or as Jesus puts it, what is that to you? You follow me.